to pretend to paint or act. I suppose they each get a percentage of the take. That would make a great article. I can't help get the feeling I'm being used as an insider source, said Amelia lightly. Tell me about your family. Laura closed her notebook and tucked it back into the satchel, along with Amelia's book. I have a girl and a boy. My husband's working on a manuscript, but also works for the public library, where we live. She quickly explained their situation and was pleased to see Amelia's face break out into a big grin. You live in that monstrous beast of a library? Simply marvelous. I'd love to see it someday. Of course, anytime. A noise arose from above, presumably the bedroom, followed by a clumping down the stairs, before a pretty but disheveled young woman appeared, wrapped in a blanket. She regarded Amelia with heavy-lidded eyes.
You're back so late.
Amelia nodded. And you've been fast asleep the whole time.
What else am I supposed to do?
She drew close and planted a soft kiss on Amelia's lips. Laura had known that women loved other women, of course, and heard that the new Bohemians were rife with such couples, including men who loved men. Back in college, there had been a couple of girls in her dormitory who were rumored to be lovers, and while the other students exclaimed revulsion at the very idea, Laura had found herself staring at the pair during her American literature class, wondering what it was like to love a woman. That kiss, though. The stays of Laura's corset dug into her torso as she absorbed the encounter. She'd never kissed Jack in front of others. Wouldn't dream of it. Then again, not long ago she had allowed Jack to take her in the library, albeit after hours, where the thrill of being caught heightened their every touch. She was no prude, she reminded herself. Yet these were two women, which made it both stranger and more familiar than she'd expected. She jumped to her feet. I really must be going. Would you like a cup of tea before you go? Asked Amelia. Jessie here will make it for you. Jessie's pout indicated otherwise. No, I'm fine. Thank you. Jessie, put the kettle on for me, please. Jessie straightened and left. Laura was out of her element downtown. She had to remember she was a reporter, not a participant. Are you shocked? Asked Amelia once Jessie had cleared the room.
A little, I suppose.
She rose and accompanied Laura to the door. I do wish to have children one day, though. I admit I envy you that. What are your children's names?
The boy is Harry. He's 11. Pearl is 7. Jack's manuscript of late has been more difficult than he expected, so he's up so late working on it. Then he has to be up at 6 for work. It's all too much.
She stammered on about nothing and everything, her mouth forming words before she could even consider the thought behind them. Amelia shot her a direct, knowing gaze. Burning with embarrassment, Laura finally left.
Chapter 9. New York City, 1993.
I need to find out where in the Antarctic has the largest population of penguins. Can you help me?
The question sent a surge of adrenaline through Sadie. An hour ago, she'd gotten a call at her desk in the Berg, asking if she would cover for a reference librarian who'd fallen ill, and had jumped at the chance. Claude had been annoying her all day with his overly solicitous questions about the exhibit, and she told him to cover the room while she manned the reference desk. Here, in the catalog room of the library, she was like a dolphin in water. Or perhaps a penguin. The patron asking about penguins was a writer of geography books who often worked out of the library, and Sadie was happy to help. Behind him, another patron in an officious-looking dark suit began to speak, but Sadie cut him off with a curt, "I'll be with you in a moment." She came out from around the desk and led the penguin patron to one of the many card catalogs that stood on the perimeter of the wall. The drawer gave an efficient swoosh as she opened it, and she worked her way through the index cards, speaking aloud the pertinent call numbers and titles as he wrote them down on call slips. Back at the desk, she fed the call slips into the pneumatic tube.
"You can pick the books up in the reading room," she said.
"My guess is that the correct answer is the Danger Islands. I believe approximately 1.5 million penguins reside there, and are kept safe from human interference by heavy ice floes that make landing boats a dangerous undertaking." With a hearty thanks, he was on his way.
"Wow." The man who'd been waiting in line stepped up to the desk. "How do you know all that stuff about the penguins?"
He spoke out of the side of his mouth like he was being sarcastic.
"It's my job."
"Now I know who to turn to if I see a penguin waddling around."
"I assure you they prefer to stay south of 14th Street."
He laughed, which drew nasty stares from the other patrons, but gave Sadie a small thrill. She wasn't known around the library for her sense of humor.
"Now what can I help you with?"
"I'm Nick Adriano. Dr. Hooper brought me in as a consultant regarding the theft."
She knew that the director was hiring more security, but she hadn't realized it would involve a consultant. He looked to be in his early 50s, his hair completely gone on the top of his head, thinning around the sides but cut close, like he didn't dispute the fact that the battle was almost over. The curve of his pate was balanced by a square jaw. She caught his eye and realized he was probably sizing her up the same way. Not that it mattered, but she'd put on her favorite dress today, featuring giant magnolia blooms over a bright pink background, knowing that she'd be stopping by the donor cocktail party at 5 o'clock. She glanced up at her watch. It was 4:15. She really should be there by now. She lowered her voice.
"I assume you're investigating the theft of the diary?"
"I am. Do you have a moment?" he asked.
"I'm done here, but on my way downstairs. If you like, we can talk as we walk."
She joined Mr. Adriano on the other side of the desk.
"I heard you were called No Stumpin' Sadie, and now I see why."
She hated that name, like something from an old Broadway musical.
"It's just a matter of knowing where to start, which I assume is very similar to what you do in your job."
"Like right now, where I'm starting with you."
"As you should. What questions can I answer for you?"
"This book. It was in the cage in the stacks?"
"It was a notebook, not a book. And yes,
that's where we keep a majority of the Berg collection, as we've outgrown our current space and new locked bookcases aren't to be installed in the third floor space until later this year. I'll be very relieved once it's all under our aegis, as obviously the stacks are not safe."
"Obviously. But first we have to look closely at those who have access to the collection, as you can imagine. When did you discover it missing?"
"Exactly 1 week ago, on the 30th of March."
"What made you go look for it?"
"It was to be included in our upcoming exhibit, Evergreen. I was planning to begin working on the description of the diary for the catalog. My job as temporary curator is to ensure that the preparations go smoothly and make sure there are no surprises."
"What kind of surprises?"
"Any damage, anything out of place." But it was nowhere to be found.
The memory of not finding it in its box brought back a muted panic.
"When did anyone from the Berg last see it?"
"My coworker Claude had taken it out a few weeks before it went missing. He says he put it back right after."
"And you and Claude were the only ones who had access to the locked cage?"
"Along with Marlene and the director, yes. Have you talked to Claude yet?"
"I did, earlier today."
So he hadn't started with her, as he'd stated previously. She waited, but he didn't elaborate. What if Claude had thrown some kind of suspicion on her? She wouldn't put it past him, especially after he'd been skipped over for the curator position.
"What did he say?"
"He was helpful."
She hated not knowing what was going on.
"I'm assuming that, in cases like these, the staff has a tendency to turn on each other. I assure you that I will do no such thing. Claude is a fine man, but I hope you take whatever he says with a grain or two of salt."
Had she said too much? It had been some time since a man had looked at her so intently, since Claude and, before that, Philip, and Mr. Adriano's interest, even if it was professional, unnerved her.
And why is that exactly?
We dated briefly. Well, not really. No. Never mind. The words came out with a faint English accent, much to Sadie's horror. Her mother used to do the same whenever she was nervous, and the affectation always irritated Sadie. Yet here she was doing the same thing. She'd never hear Pearl's voice again. The thought made her eyes burn.
Ms. Donovan, are you all right?
She pulled herself together. Last week, I got a promotion, although it's only temporary, and he did not. And I would not be surprised if he were less than generous in his description of me. I assure you, the library is paramount to me. I would never harm it in any way. God, she sounded like an idiot. Protesting too much and all of that. They'd reached the door to the room where the cocktail party was being held. Dr. Hooper was probably wondering where she was. I've arrived at my destination, Mr. Adriano, and I'm afraid I have other business to attend to. Of course, if you need anything else, you can find me in the Berg during business hours.
Are you trying to get rid of me?
The side of his mouth rose up again like he was amused. Like this was all a joke. Not at all. But I must make an appearance. It's a cocktail party for donors and trustees, and I promised Dr. Hooper I'd attend.
I'll join you then.
She hesitated a moment before stepping back and allowing him to open the door for her. Very well. Inside, the room was crowded and hot. A waiter came by with glasses of wine on a tray, and they each took one, sipped, and looked about the room. See any suspects? She asked.
At this point, I suppose everyone is a suspect. How long have you worked at the library?
8 years. How long have you been a security consultant? His smile spread slowly, like he was trying to hold it back.
5 years. Before that, I was a cop at the 23rd Precinct. When I retired, I started my own security firm. We're brought in when something goes wrong.
May I ask, who are your typical clients?
Auction houses like Sotheby's, high-end private families, that sort of thing. She nodded her approval.
So you're discreet?
I am.
That will be helpful in this case. Often libraries that are robbed prefer to keep the incident quiet so that donors and trustees, she motioned with her glass around the room, don't pull their support, which runs counter to the possibility of recovering the stolen object, unfortunately.
So you're saying it's a choice between protecting the institution or locating the artifact? Can't we do both?
Before she could answer, Dr. Hooper came barreling over, trailed by Claude.
Mr. Adriano. Sadie, said Dr. Hooper. We have a problem.
He pointed to the door and they all followed him outside into the hallway. He looked around, as if checking to make sure they had privacy.
There's been another theft.
What was stolen and from where?
Asked Mr. Adriano. He straightened up, his eyes bright. Claude responded, staring right at Sadie.
A first edition of the Scarlet Letter. From the cage.
Dr. Hooper leaned into their small circle.
It was taken from the cage for the Berg collection?
Sadie repeated, her mind whirling. Claude was gray.
Yes.
But it wasn't missing when we did the shelf read.
No, it wasn't.
Claude spoke fast, trying to explain, his voice rising.
I brought it up from the cage to my desk yesterday to review it for the exhibit. I locked it back up before I headed home for the evening, I swear, but when I went back down this afternoon, it was gone.
Didn't we have the locks changed? Asked Dr. Hooper.
We did, said Mr. Adriano,
which ruled out Marlene. Dr. Hooper turned to Claude.
I'm afraid, Claude, since you were the last person to have handled it, we'll have to restrict your access. For now. Please hand over your key.
Claude, looking sick, pulled it out of his pocket and did so. Sadie was now the only person left standing other than Dr. Hooper, who had access to the collection in the cage. Ultimately, she was responsible, as the book thefts occurred on her watch as curator. This was personal, as if someone had broken into her home and rifled through her own belongings.
"What's the resale possibility for the addition?" asked Dr. Hooper.
Sadie jumped in to answer. "It's probably much easier to sell than the Virginia Woolf diary, which is one of a kind. There are several first editions of the Scarlet Letter out there."
"How much do you estimate it's worth?" asked Mr. Adriano.
"Somewhere around $10,000.
The words stuck on Sadie's tongue.
Dr. Hooper dismissed them and headed back into the party, his mouth a grim line. Claude slunk off, hands in his pockets, leaving behind Mr. Adriano and Sadie. "How much experience do you have dealing with rare book thefts?" she asked.
"We've run into a couple of incidents, but usually we deal with art or sculpture."
"It's not the same."
"Obviously not."
"Do you think Claude's involved?"
He shrugged. "I couldn't say at this point. Nor would I, to you."
"I want to recover our property as much as you do."
"Whose property?" He'd caught her there.
"The library's, of course." She had to make him see that a book could be as important as a Picasso. To not only know that, but to be emotionally invested in it as well. "If you don't mind, I'd like to introduce you to the Berg collection. Would that be all right?" He agreed, and not reluctantly, which was a good sign. As they walked down the hallway, she asked, "What sort of books do you like to read?"
"I like nonfiction. And poetry."
Now that was a surprise. She'd been expecting to hear the name of the latest thriller. "What kind of poetry?"
"John Ashbery. Walt Whitman. Resist much, obey little."
She paused just outside the door, smiling. "Come with me." In the Berg, she pulled out her keychain and stuck the key into one of the locks in the glass cabinets. She took out a box and placed it on the empty table, put on her gloves, and then carefully sifted through its contents until she found what she was looking for. "Do you know this one by Whitman? You Lingering Sparse Leaves of Me."
"It was in the annex to Leaves of Grass."
"Here's an early draft, written in his own hand." She slid it out of its protective shield and laid it on the table, stepping aside so he could see. The paper was stained brown in places, like coffee had been spilled across it. He leaned in closer.
"But this is different from the one I've read."
"Exactly. That's what makes it special. We can see Whitman's thought process, how the poem evolved. Look at the pencil marks." She pointed without touching the page. "He's written final version on the top right corner, then crossed it out. Some of the lines are quite different in several places from the one that was eventually published. Like here. The phrase, 'You meager little banners,' is changed to 'pallid banner staves.'"
"And the final line here reads, 'My heartiest and my last.'" He looked at her. "What's the real version again?"
"The one that was published reads, 'The faithfulest, hardiest, last.'"
"I like that better," he said.
"So do I."
"To think he wrote this as he was sitting around drinking his coffee all those years ago." Mr. Adriano shook his head. "Imagine that."
"You could say that it's an active representation of the human act of creation. These stains, rips, and crossouts are visual records of the work as it was first put on paper and then revised. On some manuscripts, you can tell when the author became angry or frustrated from changes in the penmanship. One of my favorite mentors in college, Professor Ashton, used to say that it's a bridge from the reader to the author. One that provides far more than just the mechanical representation of the content."
"A bridge. I like that."
"So you see why this is so valuable." She carefully placed it back into the protective sleeve. "We can understand how he got from there to here, why he chose each word after considering and discarding others."
He looked around. "So everything in the Berg collection is like the Whitman draft?"
"Some are more interesting than others. For example," she reached down to the bottom shelf and pulled out the infamous cat paw letter opener.
"What the?"
She explained the provenance and was pleased when Mr. Adriano grinned.
These archival manuscripts are important, she added. Even the administrative records from the library when it was first built are vital to understanding its history.
History is made by people in power making decisions, and their notes and writings reveal the decision-making process. She thought of Laura Lyons, who hid her life away. How ironic that Laura's granddaughter had made a career of the very ephemera that she'd had destroyed upon her death.
Records should be saved.
The next morning, Sadie took a break from her work in the Berg to bring a couple of Danishes to Mr. Babenko in the bindery. As she turned down the hallway, she spotted a familiar figure outside the door, knocking. Mr. Adriano.
You can just go in.
She indicated the doorknob with her elbow, her hands full.
It's open.
He listens to jazz on his Walkman while he works, so he can't hear you. Mr. Babenko looked up from his work, delighted as they entered and took off his headphones.
Sadie! With delicacies, no less.
He smiled at Mr. Adriano.
I was talking about the pastries, of course. Of course,
Mr. Adriano replied cheerfully.
To what do I owe this pleasure?
I'm just here for a social visit, said Sadie. Mr. Adriano's probably here on business.
She sat down at the table and nibbled at a Danish. Mr. Adriano looked at her as if he were deciding whether to dismiss her, but then returned his attention to Mr. Babenko, reaching out to shake hands. He stopped mid-reach as Mr. Babenko held out his palm, an apologetic look on his face. Layers of skin were in various stages of peeling off his fingers, like translucent wood shavings.
Hazard of the job, said the older man. I'm sorry. What job do you do?
Asked Mr. Adriano.
Bookbinding. In 1965, I developed an allergy that stuck with me. Can't seem to stop what I'm doing, though.
Sadie smiled. Mr. Adriano didn't know that Mr. Babenko loved to boast about his hands, that they were a point of pride with him, and that long ago he had refused gloves, saying they stymied his sense of touch. Mr. Babenko is in charge of processing the new books when they come in, and restoring any that are damaged, she said.
I see.
Mr. Adriano raised his eyebrows at her before turning back to the bookbinder.
I understand you've been here a long time, and I thought I might ask you some questions. Is this about the book thefts?
Mr. Adriano shot Sadie a look, but continued.
Dr. Hooper said you were the building's unofficial historian, and that you'd even written a book on the place.
You've written a book?
Now it was Sadie's turn to be surprised. You never told me that.
A coffee table book back in the 60s. Out of print now. Out of date as well. What with the new stacks added under Bryant Park. How can I help you, Mr. Adriano? I was inspired by Ms. Donovan here, who gave me a lesson in the value of archival records yesterday, and decided to do some digging of my own. I was surprised to learn that the library had an on-site detective back when the library first opened. A Mr. Gaylard, I presume, said Mr. Babenko.
Mr. Adriano took out a notebook and flipped through it until he found the correct page.
Yes. I've spent the morning investigating the paper trail to any earlier book thefts here at the library, in case we can learn from the past. And luckily, Mr. Gaylard left a trove of information behind. I've been compiling a list of prior thefts, what was taken, from where, whether or not they were recovered.
Sadie's heart thumped in her chest.
What did you learn?
She asked, her mouth dry.
The worst was a spate of them beginning in 1913.
Mr. Babenko gestured toward Sadie.
That's when your superintendent was around, right?
She smiled weakly.
I guess.
Who's that?
Asked Mr. Adriano.
I had done some digging myself, you see, in the director's archives for a project.
She went on to explain what she'd mentioned to Mr. Babenko yesterday about the superintendent being a suspect.
What was the super's name?
Asked Mr. Adriano.
Jack. Jack Lyons.
Married to Laura Lyons, the essayist, supplied Mr. Babenko.
Mr. Adriano nodded.
I've heard of her, sure.
Sadie struggled to divert his attention. I also found a note in the director's file written by the detective, saying that it was as if the thief had dropped from the sky.
Interesting.
Mr. Adriano scribbled something in his notebook, then flipped the page.
Apparently, one of the first items stolen from the library was a book called Tamerlane by Poe. One of only 10 copies in the world, Mr. Babenko said. Never recovered. A terrible loss. How much would that be worth today? He asked.
One recently went at auction for $400,000, volunteered Sadie. Mr. Adriano let out a long whistle.
Quite the racket. Mr. Gaylord's notes mention a book row. Where is that? From around 1890 to the 1960s, there was a collection of bookstores called Book Row on 4th Avenue, just below Union Square, said Mr. Babenko. These days, bookstores that handle rare books are scattered around Manhattan. There might be one or two left on Book Row, and one of the most famous, the Strand, is just around the corner on Broadway and 12th. But most were forced out by rising rents. I've also assembled a list of bookstores that have been flagged for purchasing stolen items in the past. Would you mind taking a look?
He showed Mr. Babenko the page in his notebook.
I'm curious if anything jumps out at you as a place to start.
Mr. Babenko studied it and checked off the names of 5 bookstores.
It's all rumor, of course, but the book world is a small one, and word gets around. Thank you, said Mr. Adriano. I'll look into it.
As he left, Sadie pushed away the plate with the Danish, no longer hungry. Chapter 10. New York City, 1993. Sadie sat in the middle of the floor of Lonnie's spare bedroom, the one her mother had stayed in, surrounded by clothes, looking for something fancy to wear. She'd let herself in with her key when no one answered the doorbell, knowing that several boxes of their mother's belongings sat piled up in one corner, packed up for the Salvation Army after she'd died. But Sadie's quest had come to a screeching halt after she'd come upon her mother's wedding dresses, wrapped in plastic, at the very bottom of the last box. The first one was a cream dress suit with a peplum jacket. That was from her wedding to Sadie and Lonnie's father. The second, from her wedding with the hateful Don, was a 50s-style white silk dress that hit just above the knee. At the small celebratory dinner after, she and Lonnie had watched as their new stepfather accidentally spilled red wine down the bodice while giving a boisterous toast. Sadie ran her finger down the stain, which had faded to a dull pink. How funny that Pearl had saved them after all these years. It went against her own advice to Sadie that she hand her own wedding dress over to a consignment shop the same day she signed the divorce papers. I don't want you looking at it in your closet every time you open it, Sadie, Pearl had said. Buy yourself something pretty instead. She had, finding a turquoise cocktail dress with a tight bodice that flared into a full skirt, perfect for twirling on the dance floor. Not that she'd ever twirled, but wearing it made her feel that she might become the kind of woman who did. That dress had sent her down the thrift store rabbit hole, a quest that took up entire Saturdays that otherwise would have been filled with wondering what Philip was up to, and with whom. Whenever she wore her latest find, people asked about her outfit instead of asking about her life. It was a kind of armor, she supposed. Pearl hadn't saved much over the years. There were no letters or scrapbooks filled with photos, just some clothes, including the wedding dresses, but nothing was right for what Sadie had in mind.
So pretty!
She hadn't heard Valentina and Robin enter the townhouse. Valentina gave her a hug as Robin watched from the doorway. Lonnie and Luann have the Salvation Army coming later today to pick this all up, said Robin. Is that okay, or do you want me to delay it? No, no need to delay. She smiled as Valentina fingered a black shawl with a long fringe. Your grandmother used to wear that all the time. Valentina shrugged it over her thin shoulders, giggling. Not quite what I was hoping for, though, Sadie sighed. Robin sat on the bed.
What is it you're looking for?
Something fancy that makes me look like I'm rich.
Sadie had convinced Mr. Adriano to let her hit the flagged bookstores on his list and see if she could sniff out the Scarlet Letter. Mr. Adriano had dismissed the idea at first, but she convinced him that her knowledge of rare books was imperative in this instance. Besides, he looked too much like an ex-cop, she'd pointed out, and he hadn't been able to refute that. When he still hesitated, she'd threatened to do it with or without his support, because she couldn't stand the thought of sitting around and not taking action in some way. Reluctantly, Mr. Adriano had agreed to give it a shot, as long as they got permission from Dr. Hooper. She needed to look like a rare book collector if she was going to pull this off, and none of her own clothes would do. Her hope had been that her mother's boxes might hold a silk blouse or nice jacket that she could wear.
I know!
Valentina jumped up and disappeared. A minute later, she returned holding a cache of clothes on hangers, across two arms like she was carrying a bride over a threshold.
Try on these!
She tossed them on the bed.
Valentina, these are your mother's clothes, said Robin.
She's away on business. She won't care. Go on, try this one.
She held up a crimson double-breasted blazer that came with a chunky black belt. For a child, Valentina had a good eye. The blazer was cut long and settled nicely over Sadie's hips, and the fabric and stitching were of excellent quality. She held herself straight and stared into the full-length mirror on the back of the closet door. Not bad at all. I need something to layer on top. Is there anything that might work? Valentina put her finger to her chin, as if she were a sales lady at Saks.
What about a scarf? She has a ton of them.
Together, she and Valentina found a patterned silk scarf that picked up the color of the blazer. When Sadie draped it around her neck, Valentina laughed and clapped her hands.
You just need some pretty earrings and a necklace and you'll be good to go, said Robin.
I know! Follow me!
Valentina shrieked. They did so into the master bedroom, where Valentina rummaged through her mother's jewelry box.
Take care, Valentina.
Robin got up and gently extricated a pearl necklace and matching earrings.
How about these?
She walked over to Sadie and placed the earrings in her hand before lowering the necklace over her shoulders. Sadie put on the earrings and turned around, offering a silly curtsy to her beaming audience.
You look super fancy, said Valentina.
Very nice, echoed Robin.
What on earth is going on in here?
Lonnie stood in the doorway wearing scrubs. Luann was right behind him, a shiny carry-on bag slung over one shoulder.
Mommy's home,
said Valentina, running to her mother. Sadie looked around, seeing the room as Lonnie and Luann did. The closet, empty of a slew of clothes, the open jewelry box, and in the middle of it, herself, wearing Luann's blazer and pearls. Lonnie and Luann exchanged a look. Then Lonnie glanced irritably at the closet.
Where are Luann's clothes? What are you guys all doing in here?
I'm so sorry, volunteered Sadie. I was going through Mom's things because I needed a classy outfit, but they were all from 40 years ago, and somehow we ended up in here.
Valentina rushed to explain, picking up on her dad's distress.
Mommy's clothes are in Grandma's room because we started off in there. Doesn't Aunt Sadie look nice?
Luann smiled, but there was a weariness in her eyes. Then again, she'd been traveling the past few days and was probably looking forward to a long soak in the tub.
She sure does. And it's fine, you guys can rifle through my closet anytime.
Come on, Valentina, let's put everything back, offered Robin.
Valentina sprang up and Luann followed them out of the room. Sadie took off the blazer and hung it back up, straightening the collar as she did so. She looped the scarf around the hanger and placed the jewelry back in the jewelry box. Lonnie had taken Luann's carry-on from her and began unpacking it. The simple act of kindness on his wife's behalf made Sadie's heart melt.
Sorry about all this, Lonnie. I just meant to go through Mom's stuff.
Is there anything you want to keep of hers? I meant to ask you the other day.
Are you kidding? That goes against everything she stands for.
Remember how she tossed out Dad's clothes a week after he died? Pearl had done so the day after she'd caught Sadie weeping on the floor of his closet, enveloped in his favorite leather jacket. Pearl had gotten rid of the clothes not to punish Sadie, she knew, but to take away any conduit to sadness. She'd only wanted her children to be happy, which left no room for grief.
I do. Remember what she baked the day after Dad's funeral? Said Lonnie.
The image of a towering cake sitting on the kitchen counter came back to Sadie in a flash.
Of course. It was like a crazy 7-layer chocolate cake that normally you'd make for a birthday party or something.
Lonnie started to laugh.
Double chocolate. I ate 3 pieces and then threw up. Haven't touched one since.
She always said she liked to bake because it was scientific, that if you added the right ingredients at the right time in the right order, you'd never go wrong. She sighed.
I miss her.
Lonnie's shoulders slumped.
You okay, big brother?
Yeah, I miss her too. And it was a long day at work.
She sat on the edge of the bed and sighed.
Same here.
This made him laugh.
Don't laugh. Librarians can have bad days.
Maybe not that someone died during your shift, but still.
So someone talked too loudly?
He was grinning again.
She liked it when he teased her.
Actually, someone stole another rare book from the Berg collection.
He stored Luann's carry-on in the closet and sat beside Sadie on the bed.
Another? How?
We don't know yet.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
They've hired this security consultant, so hopefully he'll get to the bottom of it.
Between the two of you, I have no doubt you will. How did the newsletters you found go over with the director?
After everything that had happened the past week, the fact that Lonnie had remembered the small details of Sadie's work life made her want to cry.
He's interested, but he wants something more.
And he still doesn't know you're related to Laura Lyons?
To a suspected book thief?
No.
And I don't plan on telling him. I've been rereading the few interviews Laura Lyons gave, and she blatantly refuses to talk about her time in New York. Something happened. I want to find out what, just as I want to find my missing books.
Luann returned with an armful of her own clothes, having sent Robin and Valentina off to the park. Sadie explained what she needed the outfit for, and made sure to mention the detective's involvement to make it more official. Luann nodded.
Of course. That blazer suits you, by the way. Literally.
She laughed at her own joke, which made Sadie laugh, too.
Lonnie, will you go and make us some tea?
After he left, Sadie and Luann began rehanging everything back in the closet.
How's Valentina doing? Asked Sadie. With my mom's death and all.
I've been away the past couple of days, but when I've called her around bedtime, she's weepier than usual, asking questions about where Grandma went, wanting to talk about the morning when we realized she was gone. It was a shock, but she's doing okay.
Luann paused, a faraway look on her face.
I remember when I was a little kid, my parents told us they'd have to put our dog to sleep. Max was a big old hound, arthritic and slobbery, but had the sweetest disposition. They took him to the vet and came back and were upset, and I couldn't really figure out why.
You thought they meant Max was just sleeping?
Exactly. But even after it had been explained, the loss didn't resonate with me the way it did with them. I'd never seen my father cry before that. Of course, looking back now, I can see that the dog was part of their early life together. He represented so much. And since I'd never had a loss, I didn't realize what it entailed.
Sadie understood exactly what Luann meant. After the first experience of the death of someone you love, each later one is exponentially more painful, because you know how hard it will be to recover from the loss.
Yes. I was trying to explain this to Lonnie last weekend, but he didn't get it.
I knew you would.
Not for the first time, Sadie was grateful that Valentina had a mother like Luann, one who was willing to do the deep emotional dive, to examine what lay beneath the surface. Pearl had always refused, yet she'd always been capable, tough, a survivor. But of what?
How are you doing? Luann asked, breaking into her thoughts.
I'm fine, but I'm worried about what's going on at the library, with the missing books.
How's Claude with all this? Still sulking at his rejection?
I swear, you bring him up every chance you get, said Sadie, swatting Luann with her hand.
Luann had been so excited when Sadie had confessed to the stolen kiss, it had been slightly unnerving. Like maybe she considered Sadie's presence in their lives an intrusion. The lonely aunt who stuck her nose into everything, including their wardrobes, and who would now go off and get a life of her own.
It wasn't a big deal, and it's over anyway.
Thank goodness, as now I'm his boss. It's awkward enough.
Luann's expression was warm. Her mouth flickered up in a smile.
If you say so.
I keep telling you, he's got the reputation at the library of being a playboy. I dodged a bullet there. Besides, I'm going to be like my grandmother, an independent woman of letters.
That's a fine choice to make, said Luann gently. As long as you're not throwing yourself into work as a way of avoiding something else.
Like what?
Sadie felt her defenses rising.
Like the fact that your mother just passed away.
Sadie patted her knee and rose from the bed.
She really should be going. Don't worry. I'm fine.
As Sadie made her way down the steps of the brownstone, she spied Robin and Valentina in the small park across the street. Valentina was playing with three other girls on the monkey bars and gave a cheerful wave. Instead of heading home, Sadie joined Robin on a bench in the shade of an elm tree. Sadie nodded in Valentina's direction.
She looks happy.
Is she okay?
Robin nodded.
She was a little worried she'd done something wrong, but I explained to her that no one was mad at her, and it was fine.
They watched the children playing.
How long have you been in New York?
Sadie asked.
I moved to the city late last year from Massachusetts. I figured I'd do some nannying before deciding what else I might do with my life.
What are you considering?
I don't know. Maybe fashion. Did you always want to be a librarian?
I did. I loved my high school librarian, looked up to her immensely.
Robin pointed to the shopping bag at Sadie's feet.
You got out with the loot?
I sure did.
Watch me!
Valentina kicked up her legs and held a handstand, before bending her back as if she had no spine and landing on her feet, finishing with her hands held high.
It's a walkover!
Amazing!
Sadie clapped her hands.
One more time, bendy girl.
Valentina took a moment to prepare before launching into the move.
Be sure to look at the ground as you go over, advised Robin.
Nicely done. Do you want some carrots?
Robin dug into her handbag and pulled out a plastic bag of carrot sticks. Valentina gnawed on one while leaning on Sadie, one arm thrown around her neck.
Robin said all the grown-ups are acting weird because of Grandma's death, she said.
Sadie shot Robin a look of gratitude and pulled Valentina closer.
I suppose we are. Sometimes after someone dies, the people left behind can act funny because they miss her. Your mother was very sweet, said Robin.
Sadie raised one eyebrow.
I don't know if I'd use that exact word.
That last night, I do wish I'd been kinder to her, though.
Don't worry, Aunt Sadie.
Valentina leaned in, putting her forehead against Sadie's. She smelled of clean laundry.
I came back to say goodnight. Grandma was upset, but then I told her it was okay, and she smiled, and said she knew the truth about the stolen tambourine and hadn't told a soul. She said she was good with secrets.
Sadie pulled back, studying her niece.
The truth about what?
The stolen tambourine.
The girl wasn't making sense. Pearl hadn't played any instruments. Sadie's father was the only one with musical talent in the family. And Sadie didn't remember any tambourines lying around.
Did you hear any of this?
Sadie turned to Robin, who shook her head.
I was cleaning up in the kitchen. Does it mean something to you?
Sadie shook her head and locked eyes with Valentina. A tambourine. Are you sure Grandma said a tambourine? Repeating the word, the meaning clicked in.
It wasn't a musical instrument her mother had been talking about. I think she meant to say Tamerlane. Does that sound right?
Sure,
said Valentina. Did she say who stole the Tamerlane? Valentina blew her bangs out of her eyes.
Her father.
Chapter 11. New York City, 1914.
But father promised!
Harry's wail pierced the air inside the apartment. It was all Laura could do to not strangle him. Harry, enough!
But I want to play catch!
He'd at least lowered his voice to a reasonable level, so she took a breath and tried again.
Your father is busy at work, and I have a meeting with my advisor at the university. You'll have to wait. The boys will make fun of me if I can't throw well.
Who? Who will?
The boys.
He'd been doing so well. She hated to see him lose his precarious social standing at school.
Fine, I have 20 minutes. Shall we play a quick game of catch together?
He agreed, grudgingly. He preferred his father in all matters to do with sport. That was clear enough. When Harry had been a small child, he'd needed his mother much more than Pearl had. Harry had sought out Laura's attention, asking her question after question. They talked so much that she often found her own voice ragged by the end of the day. The subjects changed as he grew older, but the inquiries were no less frequent. Why did they move to New York from the country? How many people live in New York? Could he build a treehouse in the park behind the library? Why was the woman begging on the stairs of the library? Whenever Laura and Jack argued, Harry would ramp up his interruptions, as if trying to save them from each other. It was maddening, and oftentimes Jack would end up yelling for Harry to be quiet and send him to his room. She'd stop in after to check on him, and find him hiding under his bed covers, sucking his thumb.
He's a sensitive boy, she'd tell Jack. We must be careful.
Laura and Harry made their way outside, where a fine mist had settled over Bryant Park, coating the benches and walkways and turning the bark of the trees black. Empty of the usual pedestrians, the space felt slightly sinister. Jack had told them that the land underneath the library had been a graveyard for the poor during the first half of the last century. After the bones were moved to Ward Island across the Harlem River, a giant reservoir had been erected over the same spot. He'd pointed out how some of the old reservoir's stone walls had been incorporated into the library's foundation down in the basement, and Laura had wondered if the stones had been excavated from the graveyard, amazed at the way the layers of history settled upon each other over time. One day, would the white marble walls of the library support an even grander building? It was hard to imagine one grander than the New York Public Library. As she and Harry tossed a ball back and forth, her mind returned to what she'd witnessed at Patchen Place. For some reason, the physical interaction between Jesse and Amelia consumed her more than the radical causes and viewpoints discussed in the meeting above Polly Holiday's restaurant. The words and sentences, spoken in voluble, passionate cadences, were nothing compared to the quick touch of lips of the two women. That was unnervingly physical, tactile, in a way that Laura couldn't quite comprehend. She fumbled a throw from Harry, who teased her.
You have to hold your hands like this, Mother. Here, try again.
She did, purposefully flubbing it this time. Her son's physical skills took after her side of the family, unfortunately, instead of Jack's, and she wanted to encourage him.
You're much better suited to this than I am, she said. Try once more. Let me see if I can get it right.
This time she did, and he cheered her success as if she'd swum the English Channel. She loved her boy. His gradual transformation out of his shy awkwardness was everything she had wished for.
Lately, he could match Pearl friend for friend as they recounted their day at the dinner table, although every so often, Pearl surprised Laura by retreating into a sullen moodiness. Laura knew she missed having her mother around, even if she wasn't able to express it. Laura's own mother was no substitute, no matter how she spoiled them. But didn't Laura get to have a life outside of the library walls? She was in her prime, brimming with energy. Wasn't that only fair? The temperature was dropping with the sun, and she shuttled Harry back inside. Upstairs, she offered the children bread and butter, and then headed uptown to Columbia. Professor Wakeman was waiting behind his desk.
You're late.
He checked his timepiece with obvious disdain. Laura apologized, but then got right down to business. For my thesis, I was thinking it might be interesting to write an in-depth profile of Max Eastman, who edits the downtown magazine The Masses, and his wife Ida. You may remember they got into some hot water when they married, and she decided to keep her maiden name. Put it on their mailbox, even. Professor Wakeman regarded her as if she'd pulled a bomb out of her satchel.
I remember that. Caused quite a stir.
The press mocked them, said that she regarded the title of Mrs. as a badge of slavery. Even the letters to the editor were nasty and abusive. Laura pulled some of the pieces she'd dug up in the morgue on the first floor. They're all written by men, saying that such a notion will unleash a slew of divorces and other scandalous behavior. I want to do a follow-up.
It's old news. Nothing there.
Still, he picked up his pen and scratched something on a notepad near his elbow. She caught sight of the words just as he placed a piece of blotting paper over them. Eastman, potential story idea. So far, so good. Laura had noticed over the course of the first semester that student story ideas that had been summarily dismissed by Professor Wakeman sometimes turned up under his byline in the press. To ensure she got the thesis subject she'd wanted, she'd decided to pitch a throwaway idea first, to divert his attention. She waited.
Anything else? Professor Wakeman asked.
Well, how about something on the Heterodoxy Club? He yawned.
What a horror of a name.
They're a group of women who meet in Greenwich Village every 2 weeks and debate progressive causes.
It's a ridiculous name for a women's club. Heterodoxy? Sound like they're trying too hard to be intellectual, if you ask me.
I think it's a valuable story to cover.
Well, all right, he said finally. You may write on this subject. Do not try to shock me with any vulgarities, though.
2 weeks later, Laura attended her second meeting. This time, instead of formal speakers, each woman was asked to stand and give a brief summary of her background and why she was drawn to be a member. The stories were so varied, the family origins fascinating, from an isolated farmhouse in Maine to a decrepit mansion overlooking the Hudson River, from barely having enough to eat to a childhood of rich indulgence. Yet somehow they'd all ended up in this one place, united not for a common cause, but simply to be able to speak their minds freely, without the disapproval of husbands and fathers. The women were vastly different from each other, yet united by their desire to achieve, to overcome discrimination against their sex. During a break, Laura ducked into an empty meeting room and scribbled some notes, which she then hid in the very bottom of her satchel. Amelia invited her back for tea at Patchin Place, and again Laura accepted, but this time she didn't get flustered when Jessie appeared from the back room and placed another kiss on Amelia's lips, wrapping her arms loosely around Amelia's neck. She understood that down here in Greenwich Village, the old traditions were being subverted and altered, and that the two men standing closely on the corner might be friends, or they might be lovers, and that was fine. Jack asked her about the Heterodoxy Club meeting after he crawled into bed late that night. All she wanted to do was go back to sleep, but they hadn't had any time to check in with each other lately. She rubbed her eyes, fighting the urge to snuggle back under the quilt. "It's strange, going downtown," she answered. "I feel like I'm visiting some European city, if that makes any sense. Different customs, different issues. It's all so unfamiliar."
"Did you see your school friend? The one you'd mentioned at your parents?"
"Dr. Potter. Yes, she was there."
"Funny. I don't remember you ever mentioning her before."
Part of her wanted to tell Jack all about Amelia, as she'd told him about Professor Wakeman and some of the other larger-than-life characters from her outside life, but it would be too difficult. There were too many angles to the woman that Jack would find contradictory, and if she tried, she'd end up missing something important or stressing the wrong thing. She didn't want to talk about Amelia. "She was a few years ahead of me. I barely know her." She pulled Jack close. "I'm sorry you have to deal with all of the craziness here. The thefts, I mean."
"It's fine. You seem happy, I must say."
There was a hitch in his voice, but she was too tired to inquire further. "I guess I am." She turned over, exhausted, and fell fast asleep.
"Mrs. Lyons?"
Laura stopped short as Mr. Gaylard approached her on the steps to the library. She'd been lost in thought, trying to come up with a good lead for the book review she'd been assigned, and hadn't noticed him standing right next to one of the Lyons. She looked about quickly for the beggar, but the woman was nowhere to be seen, which was probably for the best. "Yes, Mr. Gaylard?"
"May I have a word?"
It was almost as if he'd been waiting for her. "Do you need to see me with my husband?" she asked. It was a Wednesday, so he'd be meeting with the chief engineer. "I'm heading inside, and I'm sure I can round him up for you."
"No, ma'am. I was hoping to have a quiet word with just you. This way."
He led her inside and up to the trustees' room on the second floor. A long table, one end piled high with papers, sat directly beneath a bronze chandelier, which had been decorated with a series of vaguely malevolent-looking satyrs. A bust of a notable figure took up each corner of the room: Alexander Hamilton, Washington Irving, John Jacob Astor, and finally, Joseph Green Cogswell. When Laura had asked Jack who on earth the last was, he'd proudly informed her that Cogswell was the first superintendent of the Astor Library, back in the middle of the last century. It was an awfully grand room to work out of, intended for meetings of the trustees. "Do you not have a proper office?" she asked Mr. Gaylard. "I'm sure my husband can secure you one if you prefer it."
"They're in the midst of appointing one for me. This is temporary, although I certainly could get used to it."
He waved a hand at the focal point of the room, a massive cream-colored marble fireplace, with a quote from Thomas Jefferson inscribed above the mantel. "The entire library is a remarkable place. I tell the children that constantly, that they shouldn't take any of this for granted."
"I couldn't agree more."
He gestured to a chair next to the one at the head of the table.
"Unfortunately, there are well-organized book thief rings here in New York, drawn to our city's treasure. I'm doing everything I can to figure out why our books are going missing. I'm guessing that this particular thief is educated and has access to the stacks in some way. Someone who has a rudimentary knowledge as to how to value a book."
"Why rudimentary?"
"Because he's chosen one that's too valuable to be able to easily sell."
"The Tamerlane?" He nodded.
"Unless some collector only wants it for his private collection. That does happen, unfortunately, and when it does, the books are lost forever."
He leaned forward.
"The only people who have a key to where the Tamerlane was kept are the rare book librarian, myself, and your husband."
Laura swallowed.
"May I ask you a rather delicate question, Mrs. Lyons?"
You may. I am happy to assist in any way I can. But I do need to get up soon to the apartment. The children will be getting hungry. This won't take long. I wonder, is your family having any financial trouble? The conversation was taking a strange turn. Absolutely not. We're perfectly fine. It's helpful that the residence comes with a job. We consider ourselves quite lucky.
Is that right?
Better to be straightforward, she decided. Get whatever this was out in the open. Are you wondering if my husband is responsible for the stolen books? He didn't answer, just stared, until the silence became intolerable. I must say, I resent the inference. Mr. Lyons reveres books and would never take one out of turn. He's writing a book of his own, even.
What sort of book is Mr. Lyons writing?
Mr. Gaylard asked. Jack had been working on it for so long that she wasn't quite sure what it was about anymore. Fiction. Really, I find your line of questioning unreasonable. My husband's character is sterling.
We have 4 books missing, Mrs. Lyons. I have to go down every path at this point.
4 books? Jack had only mentioned 2, Leaves of Grass and Tamerlane. Mr. Gaylard continued,
The library has guards stationed at every exit who check the bags of anyone coming in or out. The rare books are locked away, and 2 librarians staff the rare book room at all times. Yet still the books are being taken. I must find out why.
Of course you must.
That is why we are currently searching your apartment.
What? She remembered the way he'd been stationed outside the library, as if to stop her from entering. Where are my children? And Jack?
Harry and Pearl are down in the children's library, with the clerk there. Mr. Lyons is at the apartment.
She swished out of the room, the detective following behind her, down to the first floor and back up the small stairway to the mezzanine. Jack stood leaning against the banister, looking bored. He straightened when he saw her ascending, the detective behind her.
Sorry about this, love, he said. They're almost done.
He and Mr. Gaylard shook hands like they were bridge partners, not suspect and policeman. The detective glanced over to a uniformed cop who gave a slight shake of the head.
We found nothing, sir, the man said. I thank you for your patience and cooperation.
With that, Mr. Gaylard and his crew took their leave. Only after they'd entered their apartment and shut the door behind them did Laura speak. Tell me now. What is going on, Jack? The truth this time. Chapter 12. New York City, 1914. Laura straightened up their apartment, moving from room to room, making the place hers again after the intrusive search by the detective's men. The children had already scampered back in, disappearing into their bedrooms. Jack followed close behind her.
I don't get it. Now you're demanding that I tell you what's going on? If you were here more often, perhaps you'd already know.
She shoved his desk chair back into place and whirled around. Mr. Gaylard brought me to his office, asked me questions, and then told me they were searching our home. It was humiliating.
I gave him full permission, as I have nothing to hide. They're just doing their jobs.
He said that 4 books have been stolen. You'd said 2.
Again, if you'd been around more, I might have mentioned it.
What was stolen?
2 more first editions. Nothing as valuable as the Tamerlane. The thief learned from his mistake, it appears.
Jack crossed his arms.
They've taken my key away, which is fine with me, as then they'll see I've done nothing wrong. And now, if you're done with your interrogation, I'd like to get back to my writing.
So you're angry with me for being away, while you spend hours at a time on your book. Do you see how this isn't fair?
You're a mother. What did you expect?
You're a father. Doesn't that count? She remembered that cold day playing catch with Harry. how she'd created a fond memory for their boy instead of yet another disappointment. "You've been down in that basement more than up here these days. It's the only place I can write without all these distractions." Harry poked his head out from his bedroom. "I'll be quiet, I promise. It won't be loud anymore." "Harry, no, it's not you," Laura assured him. "Laura?" Her mother's voice rang out from the bottom of the stairs. "Distractions," whispered Jack. "Everywhere I look. You should be here, not her." Laura ignored him. "Mother, please come on up." Her mother paused on the top stair, one hand on the banister, unsure. She wore a Persian lamb's wool coat with a thick bow at the waist, a reminder of the cold that had encased the city the past few days. "Is everything all right?" "Of course. The children are in their rooms. Dinner is in the icebox. Jack was just on his way out." She avoided looking at him. After he'd left, Laura's mother shrugged off her coat. "You look tired, my dear." She brushed Laura's cheek with her fingers. Laura took her mother's hand and gently kissed it, the ring finger adorned with only a gold wedding band. They hadn't spoken of her sacrifice. Laura couldn't bear it. "Things may be difficult right now," her mother said, "but I want you to know that I admire what you're trying to do." "Trying is the key word. So far, barely succeeding. He's a good man. You know that, don't you? He loves you so much." Laura couldn't help wondering what might have been if she hadn't been so awestruck by Jack's dapper bearing and charm back when they met. He did love her, it was true, but their competing demands for self-fulfillment didn't fit well together, like two balloons stuffed into a small box. Her mother only wanted love out of life, and even if she hadn't achieved it for herself, she'd made sure Laura attained that goal. But at what cost? Even worse, would Laura pass on a similar blind spot to her own daughter? She was simply too entrenched in quotidian concerns to be able to step back and view her own biases as a parent clearly. After settling the children with her mother, Laura began writing the first draft of her thesis. The first paragraph had taken a good half hour, but the subsequent pages came more rapidly, albeit roughly. She'd edit and smooth out the prose later, like a sculptor working with words instead of clay. As long as she had something down on the page, she'd be able to make it work. There was so much to cover, so much going on that wasn't even mentioned in the big newspapers. She'd prove to Professor Wakeman that a woman's story, as he liked to call it, could impact history. 2 hours later, Laura slid her arm into Amelia's, as they climbed the front stairs of a handsome brownstone on the corner of Fifth Avenue and Ninth Street. She'd been invited by Amelia to a salon at what she'd said was the premier gathering place for bohemians. Inside the townhouse, the entire parlor was done in white, a white marble mantel, white painted woodwork, white velvet chairs and silk curtains, a white bearskin rug on the floor. The effect was both pristine and shocking. "Who lives here?" Laura asked. "It's like being in a blizzard." Amelia laughed. "Mabel Dodge came to the city a couple of years ago from Europe and decided to pull together the people necessary to dynamite New York," as she put it. "Every week she holds a salon for 100 that brings together those willing to shake things up." The room pulsed with energy and laughter, a contrast to the dinner parties Laura's parents had given uptown when they were still flush, where dulcet, moderated tones were the only ones tolerated. Amelia subtly pointed out the guests. "You've seen some of the women already at the Heterodoxy Club meetings, like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Emma Goldman. Near the fireplace is Alfred Stieglitz. Max Eastman, editor of The Masses, is over there, next to his wife, Ida." Laura had to smile.
I know exactly what you're thinking, said Amelia.
What am I thinking?
That they look so normal. Laura laughed. After all that terrible uproar in the press, there they were, standing side by side, sipping cocktails like any other young married couple, as if nothing had happened, as if it just didn't matter. I guess I look pretty normal as well, said Laura with a shrug. Don't sell yourself short. You're running with the new bohemians these days.
I'm here as a reporter. To report, not to run.
I see. Amelia playfully bumped Laura's shoulder with her own. You have a mission.
That's the truth. I want to write about so much, I can hardly stand it. The world is changing, and I want to be out there, taking it all down.
I love your enthusiasm, Laura. You remind me of me when I first went into medicine.
You're much tougher than I am, though. I know I have a lot to learn.